House Civil Judiciary Subcommittee is now in session. The schedule today will consist of the agenda beginning with House Bill 2042, House Bill 2046, House Bill 2044 and 2045, and last will be House Bill 2043. I'd like to call the witness on 2042, Greg Shamoff, Legislative Council.
Madam Chair, members, good morning. Greg Shamoff, Legislative Council. Thank you for scheduling our bill so promptly. I will try to return the courtesy by taking as little of your time as possible. 2042 is the classic example of what happens when you try to draft a bill too quickly. In this case, the culprit is I. Late last session, some lawyer from back east questioned whether the legislative administrator had the authority to enter into a contract. He did, but the lawyer from back east wouldn't take my word for it, wanted to see something in statute, so I quickly whipped something together that made it very, very clear that all the heads of the legislative service agencies may enter into contracts. Unfortunately, when I wrote it, I plopped the language into sections that began with the word shall, which had the effect of saying that the legislative service agency directors were required to take action through contract instead of simply authorizing them to do so. And what House Bill 2042 does is change the shall into may so that when it's appropriate, the directors can enter into contracts, and when it's not appropriate, they don't have to. Thank you.
Does the panel have any questions? Questions? I entertain a motion.
Let's see. I think we need to close the hearing first and go to work session.
Well, that's right. I do. Hearing is closed. Work session. Discussion.
Madam Chair, it just raised a question in my mind as to the legality of all the work that Mr. Shamoff has done. And if it was supposed to have been done under contract and he's not done it. So. I would move House Bill 2042 to the full committee.
Any objection? Hearing none. Pass to full committee. House Bill 2046.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2046.
Okay, Mr. Shamoff, please state your name.
Thank you. Greg Shamoff, Legislative Council. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill addresses a situation with which Representative Shetterly is quite familiar. When a committee drafts an explanatory statement for the ballot, there is a procedure in statute that allows a person who doesn't like the statement to file a petition in the Supreme Court. That statute, however, doesn't currently have any language in it that tells the person filing the petition to whom that person has to give notice. And what happened during the last election cycle was an explanatory statement committee didn't find out about the challenge to their work until after it was technically too late to enter an appearance and explain the committee's side of things. And the Supreme Court was kind enough to set aside its own timelines to allow a late appearance, but that was a great deal of work that the committee need not have gone through. And the purpose of House Bill 2046 is to put together a regimen for providing notice in these kind of cases to the Attorney General, to the committee that drafted the measure, and to the Legislative Council if it's a referral. That way, the folks who are most interested in the measure can have a chance to defend their interests in court. Late last week, Mr. Swank from the Judicial Department raised an issue of what should the consequences be if a person doesn't serve the petition as required, and I dashed together a conceptual amendment that you should have in front of you that would say if you don't serve the petition as required, the court doesn't get to hear the case. And I think Mr. Swank raises a legitimate point as to whether there needs to be a mechanism for dealing with a person who doesn't serve the petition in time, but whether this is the appropriate way to go about that. Given the Supreme Court's docket, I don't know, and I'm hoping that that's something that Mr. Swank can address when he visits with you on the bill.
Okay. Any questions of Mr. Shamo? Can I get a copy of the proposed amendment? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shamo. Mr. Brad Swank?
Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brad Swank, and I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office, and I'm here today actually to raise two issues about which I've talked to Mr. Chamoff. The first one that we wanted to raise, and I actually didn't get a copy of the bill. Excuse me, I'm not naturally a morning person. I'm not totally awake. If my voice is a little foggy, please excuse me.
It is.
The first one is the issue about consequences. This is a bill that establishes requirements, and the consequences aren't clear, and it's really a legislative policy decision about what you want to have happen if somebody doesn't serve the appropriate notice. Do you want them cut off entirely, which may mean that they file other things to try and get in and get around the cutoff? Do you want some kind of accommodation? Do you want them to pay money? Those are the kinds of policy questions that you may want to decide. I haven't actually really had a chance to discuss this with the court. Normally, they don't take policy decisions. They don't try and make policy suggestions to the legislature most of the time on this kind of thing. But it's something to consider, what you want to have happen if somebody doesn't make the filing deadline. In terms of the notice itself, it's probably a good idea that these people get notice, because the Supreme Court is actually looking to get as much feedback on these issues as it can so it can make an intelligible decision based on as much information as it can get. And it would prefer to get as full a discussion of the issues involved as it can, which sort of raises the other issue that I've got. In line 9 of the printed bill, you'll see the last two words of the line are, hear arguments. And that appears to be a statutory mandate that there always be oral arguments. And the Supreme Court, I was talking to one of the attorneys of the Supreme Court Friday afternoon, and he was noting that sometimes it may be appropriate not to have oral arguments in the same sense that you want to always have as much feedback as you can, as much input to make an appropriate, fully informed decision. Sometimes they aren't that big an issue, and they can be decided on the briefs, and the parties don't care. And the question is, do you need the words "hear oral arguments" to always hear arguments to always mandate an oral argument? If those words were removed, the Supreme Court would still try and get, in appropriate circumstances, all the information it could. But, again, it may not always be necessary to have an oral argument. Those are the points that I wanted to raise. If you've got any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Questions of Mr. Swink?
I have.
Representative Shetterly?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brad, on the first one, I think you're saying it's a policy decision for us what the consequences should be if a petition isn't filed, and then under the amendment, if a petition isn't served. Because we're not addressing the filing deadline, that's here now. Without any more on, if we weren't amending this statute, how would you read this in terms of how would the court read this in terms of consequences for failure to file? I know. As court administrator, has it ever come up? Has somebody ever come in on the sixth day and has the court denied consideration of an appeal because...
Chair Walker, Representative Shetterly, I don't know. It has been an issue in the past where people haven't been gotten notice and have tried to come in late. I really don't know whether somebody's been denied. Generally, the Supreme Court tries to be reasonably flexible in these things because of the importance of getting an appropriate statement out to the people in the voters' pamphlet, and that's what this is about. But I don't know whether anybody's been denied.
Follow up?
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Shetterly has followed.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I guess I would consider this to be probably jurisdictional, isn't it? This statute creates jurisdiction in the court to hear this and then establishes, it says if, it doesn't say, but if you don't, but I mean the if, I think, conveys what the consequences would be, I guess.
Chair Walker, Representative Shetterly, I think that it's probably generally looked upon as being jurisdictional. I don't know that it always is. As I said, I got the bill late Friday afternoon in my stack and went through them and looked for people over there to talk to because it's not... I try and stay away from ballot measure explanations if I can.
Mm-hmm. And one more, if I may.
Yes.
And on your other point, at the end of line 9, it seems to me that if we delete the two words, hear arguments, then we've actually, then what the statute says is the court shall review the statement and certify an explanatory statement. See, we may inadvertently, in that case, take the option of oral argument out. It sounds like it would be a review just basically on the record, review the statement and certify an explanatory statement. Would it be, if you want to get away from the requirement of the apparent requirement of oral argument in all cases, would it be something satisfactory, perhaps, to say something like the court shall review the statement and then consider the arguments, or review the statement and the arguments, or something, so that at least we leave in there the
Chair Walker, Representative Shetterly, or it could say consider arguments as appropriate.
Yeah.
Something like that. I'm not sure. I don't believe the Supreme Court is trying to cut out appropriate argument and offering, but something like that would be fine.
Representative Ringo.
Thank you. Hi. Mr. Swank, maybe I missed it in your discussion with Representative Shetterly, but did you have a suggestion as to what the consequences might be? Were you offering one?
Chair Walker, Representative Ringo, I actually didn't. I haven't had a chance to talk to, as I said, I haven't had a chance to talk to anybody over in the legal counsel for the Supreme Court's office, except very briefly on Friday, and they said, what they said, he said, was, I'm not sure that you want to make it jurisdictional, but he was on his way. I caught him at 5:05, and he was on his way out the door, and it's worth considering what you want to make it in terms of, you've got somebody who is challenging the argument. You're going to have a scramble if they get things in late for people to make responses. If you throw it out, I mean, that's sort of a political decision. Do you have unsatisfied constituents? I don't know the answer to that. It's really sort of a political substantive issue. I wanted to raise it because if it's not raised and not addressed in legislation, then people have to spend money litigating about what should happen, and we would rather have it answered by you than have people have to hire lawyers.
One more.
Yes, Representative Ringo.
Is there a definition somewhere of the method of service, shall serve copy? Is that set forth in a different place in the statute?
Chair Walker, Representative Ringo, I believe service is provided under the ORCP and probably addressed under the Oregon Rules of Appellate Procedure, which they have. I think that's something they have authority to address.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Shetterly, you have another question?
Thank you. If I could ask Mr. Chamoff to come back up. Before, going to stay there.
Just a moment. Do you have another question for...
You
want to addition to? Okay. Perfect. Okay.
They can talk it over.
All right. Mr. Chamoff.
Looking at the statute, this this plays into my question I have in my mind. My understanding, having served on these explanatory statement committees, has been that in order to file a petition challenging the explanatory statement, the petitioner must have submitted comments to the committee. Has that been the interpretation?
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, yes.
I'm just curious, because if you, and maybe we need to do a little more work with the statute, because if you look at the first sentence, it says, any person dissatisfied with an explanatory statement for which suggestions were offered at the Secretary of State's hearing may petition. That sounds to me like you don't have to have been the person offering the comments. It's any person if comments were offered. Would you read it that way?
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, I certainly see that there could be alternate readings of that, yes.
Might be worth having some further amendment done on this to try and touch that up, too, because I think that has been the interpretation, that if you're going to petition the court to challenge an explanatory statement, you have to have participated at the front end by offering comments. This seems to me to be a little broader than that requirement, and because the reason that plays into what I was thinking was, I don't have, if that's the case, if we're requiring that it be somebody who has made the comments before the explanatory statement committee and then those comments have not been accepted, I don't have a problem making 5 days a jurisdictional limit. We want these things to move quickly, and they're already in the game. They should know the rules, and they should be ready to move. They know that this ballot title stuff goes quickly. But if it's a broader universe of people that are authorized to challenge, and it could be just anybody, as long as somebody made suggestions, then I think that 5 days may be a little strict. So we could tighten it up on the front end to say that you have to have been one to make the challenges in the first place, and then within 5 days after that, file a petition. I don't have any problem with that. I think that keeps the ball rolling, and we need to look at that, too, to make sure this is expedient.
Madam Chair, may I suggest that I prepare amendments to address the service, the first sentence to make it clearer, and also the oral argument, share those with Mr. Swank, and then we bring this matter up again once the Judicial Department's had a chance to fully review how it would affect that branch.
I think that would be appropriate.
Mr. Chairman? Or Ms. Chair.
Keep it a little late. Who's on first?
You're on last.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Chairman Walker. Greg, I'm not sure this is exactly on point, but I had a notion that it might also be of use when something is filed Wait a minute. That's okay. I'm sorry. Never mind. This is not the bill for which I had the brilliant idea. Never mind.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Shamoff, if you would prepare those and resubmit them, we will reopen this hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hearing on 2046 will be continued when Mr. Shamoff submits the additional amendments. House Bill 2044 and 2045. Mr. Shamoff, these two are much the same. And are you?
Yes, you are
the only witness on both. This is relating the confidentiality of records regarding the 12 years confidentiality. If you would address those, and of course we would make the decision on them separately, but since they are the same issue, we would discuss them at the same time. Mr. Shamoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Greg Chamov, Legislative Council. The issue that these bills address came up with the state archivist, who suggested that the public would benefit from being able to review the drafting files of the Legislative Council as the public can, for example, the minutes of this meeting and the exhibits that were tendered to the committee. The Legislative Council Committee agreed that after a certain point it would be appropriate to open up the drafting files, but the question was at what point? And House Bill 2044 makes the policy decision that you go back 12 years from today, and anything older than that a person could now look at. House Bill 2045, acknowledging that up until today, a member has had at least the right to reasonably expect that our drafting files would be kept confidential, shouldn't have the files opened up without knowledge that that was in fact going to happen. And so what 2045 does is start the 12 years running after this session, and then in 2013 people would start to be able to look at our drafting files from starting the 2003 session. So the question is, if you want to pass either bill, you're making a policy decision to open what are currently confidential files to the public, and the decision between the two bills is whether you want to go back in time or whether you want to move from the forward forward only.
Thank you, Mr. Chamov. Do you have any questions for Mr. Chamov? Representative Ringo.
I was just wondering, has this been an issue? Have there been FOIA requests? Have there been attempts to keep these confidential?
Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, a few times a year we get a request from a citizen to open the drafting files to inspection, and we have always declined that request, and that request our position has been upheld by the Attorney General when there's been a complaint made about the position taken.
Representative Lowe.
I think Representative Backen was next. I'm sorry.
Representative Backen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. Greg, just for curiosity's sake, why 12 years? Why not 10, or why not 18, or why not 7?
Madam Chair, Representative Backlund, we keep files in our office for 10 years. After 10 years, we ship them to the state archivist. So that was where the distinction between 10 and 12 years came. If they're 12 years old, they're not on our premises. They're with the state archivist, where people would normally go to research things. If they're 10 years old, we're probably still using them.
Thank you.
Representative Lowe.
Now, here's the one that I had the brilliant brain cloud about. Mr. Chamov, the files include all of the candid comments made on the phone to Ledge Council. There's a phone log in the file belonging to these bills. This conversation develops between the drafter and the representative who has requested them to be drafted. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, ordinarily not. Occasionally the file does contain some sort of a transcription of the conversation between a drafter and a member, though, yes.
Okay, and these are fairly informal notes?
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, yes.
Would that be part of the record?
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, yes.
And some bills are initiated, I'm not sure the freshmen are aware of this, but some bills are initiated with mother's notes from the representative to somebody who is sent down to your office to ask that something be done. Sometimes these notes are so informal that they rather candidly outline the problem and then request Ledge Council to fix it. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, yes, indeed.
Sometimes these mother's notes are somewhat humorous and very candid and often uncomplimentary to the person who has caused the perceived problem to the representative. Is that correct, Mr. Chairman?
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, I think that characterization of a note, it wouldn't be something that happens often, but I can recall specific instances, yes.
I'm sure you can. So can I. So would this be part of what would be made the public record as well, Mr. Chamos?
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, yes.
I was afraid of that. Thank you.
Representative Shirley.
Well, that kind of raises the question I had in my mind. I think my bill files down at LC must be pretty bland, but what kind of things are in there?
Never mind.
Speaking in general terms, not attributing anything to anybody's bill in particular, but what would be in a file?
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, first, yes, your files are relatively bland, and second, the files contain the form of the request, whether it came in on a napkin or on the form that we prefer.
I did a napkin once.
prefer that people use. It contains a sheet in which I've made an assignment to a specific drafter, plus entered in different subject headings so that we can track the bill through our system. It may contain my notes or the drafter's notes from research pursued to help craft the bill. It may contain notes of conversations between the drafter and whomever the drafter sought information to help with the bill. It would contain draft amendments. It may contain earlier versions of the bill itself. That would be about it.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. I know that in private practice, one of the reasons you have the rule of confidentiality between attorney and client is to encourage full disclosure and frank discussion by a client with an attorney without fear that that's going to get out beyond the four walls of the conversation. And that's often critical in advising a client in a private case in litigation or something like that, so they know that the other side is not going to hear the holes in their case or the concerns that they have or lots of other reasons about that. And I guess we're balancing something here, which is on the one hand a public process. We are not, this is not a private attorney and client relationship here. We're elected officials and legislative counsel is employed by the legislative assembly, and so very much a public function. Yet at the same time, in the details of that, with regard to these specific bills, do you find that confidentiality necessary to sometimes get at what a member is after or to advise a member? Are we throwing a monkey wrench in here? Do we need a level at which there is confidentiality to ensure full disclosure and frank discussion at the very earliest levels?
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, we find that the obligation of confidentiality greatly enhances the ability to have the kind of frank discussions that may need to take place to enable us to draft a bill that matches the requester's intent.
Manager.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Greg, I'm also concerned about the timing of this, 12 years. We have quite a few young, it's probably too late for me, but we have quite a few young people in this body who are probably going to serve their 12 years in this body, serve the people. And then on their 12th year, when they are no longer eligible to serve, they would probably like to go on and serve the people in another way, perhaps in another office or maybe in their local communities. If suddenly somebody, say, wants to run for governor, maybe some enterprising news media person could go in there and ferret out all those mother's notes and those private notes between you as the representative's attorney and them to see what their thought processes were when they did this or this or this. Why the 12 years? Why 12? Was that a number that was picked out because that's how long we can serve, and then disclosure might make the next election somewhat more entertaining?
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, to address 2 points. First, the Office of the Legislative Council isn't taking a position on either of these bills. It was simply an issue raised by the state archivist that was, at least in the committee's view, sufficiently important to warrant a public debate. The 12 years, although it happens to coincide with the permissible duration of your stay in the legislature, was in fact chosen because if the files are 12 years old, they aren't on our premises anymore and we don't use them. The coincidence with the length of your term limits was merely that, a coincidence.
Representative Shetterly.
I'm inclined to suggest that we defer action on this today and give it some thoughtful consideration. It's an interesting one. Again, it presents some good policy choices. One is that issue of openness and fair to full disclosure to the public. The other, of course, and I think I got it with Mr. Chamov in the last exchange that I had with him, is I think it also serves the public well to have a free flow of information between members and legislative council so that we get at what we're trying to get at and we don't hamstring either legislative council or the members in their ability to be frank and feel comfortable in their communications right at the front end. There's plenty of opportunity for the public to see the product when the bill is drafted, it's dropped, and now we're in the hearing process. But I think in that front end, I think there may be more to be said to benefit the public in this and making sure that there is an opportunity for a candid discussion between members and their attorneys about the development of these things. And partly, too, some of these bills never go anywhere. And you may not get beyond a bill draft. And at that point, what really is the point? I mean, nothing has been done, nothing has been affected, no public policy has been implemented or not implemented, that was at least presented to the legislature for a choice. So I'm inclined to think that the public is just as well served by encouraging that level of frankness and maintaining a comfort level between members and legislative council that those are confidential communications at that very earliest level in the process.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Representative Shetterly raises some points that kind of coincide with my thought. I'm thinking perhaps the greatest meeting in the history of America is the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787. James Madison didn't publish or didn't have published those records until 1830. He didn't want to embarrass anybody because he was very frank in his judgments of each individual. And so he waited a long time, unlike nowadays where it's kiss and tell as quickly as possible on many things. So the length of time as it relates to confidentiality is of concern to me too. And so I would agree that we perhaps need to defer this and for further thought and discussion.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Vic, I agree with you about the length of time. If these do have to be disclosed, I think the further out the better in terms of encouraging frankness in dialogue between us and our attorneys. But the other thing that strikes me is that if you do pass the alternative 4-5, and from here on, we're going to have to expect that our work product, or even in its seedling stages, would be exposed to public scrutiny. I guess I could live with that if I absolutely have to. I probably would prefer not to, and this is the reason. I'm concerned that we're going to quit being frank with you, at least in writing, and then come down and it's going to slow your work down, and you're already got more than enough to do than to sit there and take notes when some legislator comes down and says, well, I'm not going to put this in writing, but this is what I want you to do. So you scratch your head and then try to come up with some succinct way to put it. So I think that both of them are bad ideas, but the 4-5, 4-6, is it 4-6 that, no, I guess it's 4-5 that has the delayed is the least onerous to our efficient operation.
Madam Chair. Mr. Chamoff, what happens now with the files that go to archives? Can anyone, I mean, are there people that can access them?
Madam Chair, Ms. Chartel, only the people from our office.
And the requesting member, I assume.
Madam Chair, Representative Shirley, I presume that would be the case. It simply, to my knowledge, hasn't happened.
Representative Ringo.
I would just make a slight comment in support of public disclosure. I think, in general, government secrecy is a bad thing. We see that at the federal level a lot. And I'm kind of working in the dark as a freshman. I'm trying to figure out what conversations you have with legislative counsel that might possibly come back. And the kinds of things that I've floated by them, frankly, I don't care if they're public right now, much less 12 years from now. And I think there is some damage to be done by keeping things too confidential in terms of eroding public confidence in our government. And I would just throw that idea out there for consideration.
Sometimes, may I? Thank you, Madam Chairman. Sometimes people with very unusual ideas come to representatives and ask them specifically to get a bill drafted that prohibits anyone from making bird calls after 6 o'clock at night, or you know, some unusual request. Have you had some requests that were a little bit out of the mainstream, you could say?
Madam Chair, Representative Lloyd, prefer not to answer that question.
and for the sake of trying to serve the constituent, oftentimes a representative might at least have that bill drafted. And rather than embarrass the original requester, which is not necessary, but it is necessary for us to have dialogue with the original constituent that makes a request, sometimes these things just ought not to, in my opinion, be the scintillating bedtime reading of somebody who is a historian, wants to know what your every thought was. And that's the kind of entertaining bedtime reading of the legislative council to which I referred. I do, in general, agree that public disclosure is, we're doing the public's business, that's fine, but oftentimes there are two things you don't want to watch, making sausage and making legislation, and perhaps we'd better, in my opinion, at least respect the confidentiality expectation that has gone heretofore.
Mr. Shetterly.
I think that is a...
Excuse me, Representative Shetterly.
I respond to both. I think it's a good point, and Andrea whispered it in my ear, too. Because my bill files, I think, as Greg has said, are really pretty boring and would not make much interesting reading or embarrassing for me either. But I think it is true that you do have constituent requests sometimes that you come in that will come in for a particular bill, and sometimes the best way to show a constituent that their idea is not going to work is to get it drafted. And so you've got the document in front that you can outline to them, say, look, this is it, and this is why it won't work. And so you do get drafts, I think, from time to time on bills that you intend never to put forward, but you use for other purposes. And I think there may be a good example of a case where even though there may not be anything particularly embarrassing in the bill, just the very fact that a request on a particular subject has been made could prove to be embarrassing to a constituent as well as to the member, and also not provide any real public purpose. And to create now an expectation or a certainty that this is going to become public in the not too distant future, I think could chill that kind of very beneficial use of the drafting process.
Okay. No more questions for Mr. Shamoff? Okay. Being none, I will close this hearing at this time, and we will not move to a work session. Thank you, Mr. Shamoff.
That was fun. That was the most fun I've had so far this session. I think it's going to be pretty dry around here if we don't get going. Come on, guys. Light up.
Okay. Last on our agenda today, House Bill 2043. Mr. Chamoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, although... House Bill 2043 contains in it some policy choices that you'll need to make. We refer to this bill as our housekeeping bill because the process by which the committee puts the bill together each session is to look at the statutes that tell us how to do our business, which were adopted in the 1950s, and then compares that to how we really do business or how we ought to do business, and then try to, where appropriate, modernize the statutes to reflect the better or current practice. What I've done is try to put together a section-by-section analysis of the bill, and what I propose to do is just walk you through briefly with each of the changes so that you can get a clearer picture of exactly what it is we're trying to accomplish. ORS 171.130 is the section that allows pre-session filing of bills. And in the past, the Judicial Department has brought its bills to be introduced by the Interim Judiciary Committee because the Judicial Department, presumably through an oversight, was not included among the entities that could pre-session file bills. And the view of the committee was there was no need to put the Judicial Department through the extra step of putting its bills in through a committee, and that it ought to be able, like the Executive Department, to be able to pre-session file bills.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Shetterly.
Question about that section. Greg, this says, this is not the amended language, but looking at the existing statute, lines 6 through 11 provides for pre-session filing at the request of members who will serve in the session and members-elect and also then your interim and statutory committees.
it seems to me we've also seen pre-session file bills by outgoing members, have we not? Don't we see that? Members on their way out who drop a bunch of bills on their way out the door?
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, in the House, that's true, because your rules, which supersede the statute, permit that.
Okay, so that's a rule permit. I was just curious where that, how that happened. Okay. And you don't need a statutory change to make that?
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, no.
Thank you. Any other question on this? Yes. Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Chamath, is it historically one of the larger functions of the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee to tend to the to these bills, bill requests by the Judicial Department? And can we assume that if this amendment is put into place that it won't be that necessary for the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee to function during the interim?
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, I think you'd have to address that question to Representative Shetterly.
Well, he did other things besides Judicial Department.
But there were sure a lot of them.
Yeah. You had a question on a section? I have a question. Mr. Chamath, it says here to cure an oversight by allowing the Judicial Department, et cetera. Why is it presumed it's an oversight and perhaps not intentional that the judiciary should not enter into proposing legislation?
That's a good one.
Madam Chair, I guess I can't answer that. We simply assumed that had that issue been considered, that the Judicial Department would have been allowed to propose legislation for consideration by this body.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you. It seems to me I remember something in the Constitution about they can only consider things that are in contention before them. I wonder if that was the prohibition.
Thank you, Representative. That was my consideration as well, that the judiciary as the interpreter of laws, how would they interpret something that they had a hand in preparing?
That was my
question. Representative Shetterly.
I can respond to that. I guess I think one is a decisional function of the courts in actually deciding cases before. Another, and I think what this gets at, is more administrative. There is also an administrative agency that... my experience has been that the bills that the Judicial Department files are uniformly administrative in nature, and not cases, not bills addressed to cases that the courts are considering. And so in that respect, I think it's appropriate, given the administrative function of the Judicial Department as well, that they have the opportunity to propose legislation affecting the administration of the courts. Well, they certainly do it. I mean, I know the ones you see through the Judiciary Committee or through members, those are, that would, I see Brad is making his way up one more row. I don't see this as a constitutional issue particularly.
Question?
I do have
Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question is that since the Judicial Department's function is to interpret all laws, whether there are rules of how they function or not, that is something of concern. Although, maybe just running them through the Joint Interim Judiciary or would simply be a barrier to the direct confrontation with the constitutional provision that prohibits them from taking on something that's not in controversy.
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, Mr. Swank may want to weigh in on this. We don't see any constitutional problem with either the Executive Department or the Judicial Department of Government proposing legislation for your consideration. This bill to allow pre-session filing by the Judicial Department is mostly an effort to relieve one of your interim committees of some work.
Mr. Swank, do you wish to testify?
Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, again, I'm Brad Swank with the State Court Administrator's Office. This was not, we don't have, the Judicial Department doesn't have an issue with this bill one way or the other. We haven't had trouble getting legislation in. If it makes it easier for your committees or for Legislative Counsel's Office to get them in earlier, we're supportive of that. As Representative Shetterly says, most of the things that come in from the Judicial Department are administrative kinds of things. For instance, we introduce a bill, we have a study, joint commission with the bar, that works on new judgeships, and the legislation that's introduced as a vehicle for new judgeships and for the legislature to discuss the potential for new judgeships is a bill that's introduced by the Judicial Department generally. Bills relating to salary, to records, to administrative kinds of things. Like last session, we had a couple of bills in dealing with how we process paper and whether or not we can use electronic kinds of what we can use computers for. There, it's most of what the Judicial Department does, and I think we've got fewer than 30 bills this session altogether that are introduced. We don't see a separation of powers issue on this. We don't weigh in on the big policy issues that face the legislature by and large. It's the technical stuff. Legislative Counsel's Office and the Judiciary Committee generally comments on how thrilling our bills are and how they start drafting them when they need the rest. They may be even less exciting than Representative Shetterly's. but that's what we do, and this was a bill that we don't have a position on, but we don't see a separation of powers issue relating to the judiciary and the administrative functions that the Chief Justice and State Court Administrator serve in relation to the courts.
Thank you, Mr. Swank. Anyone have a question, Mr. Swank? Thank you. Okay, Mr. Chamoff, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving on to Section 2 of the bill. On page 2, lines 22 and 23, you'll see that we are proposing to add the Judicial Department specifically among the entities for whom the Legislative Council may provide drafting services. We already do provide drafting services to them as a state agency, as we're authorized to do in line 19, simply as a matter of recognizing them as a co-equal branch of government, independently elected officials. We thought it appropriate to list them along with the independently elected statewide officials as the entities entitled to obtain drafting services. That was a suggestion that came from Senator Courtney as a means of clarifying the issue and of providing the Judicial Department the respect to which he believed the department was owed. At the very bottom of page 2, we've added some language to clarify that no, we can't do legal work for the public. We get several calls a day from members of the public asking us to essentially function as a legal aid office. And we don't. And the clearer we can make this in statute so that we can point to them and say, you need to talk to legal aid or to the bar's referral folks or something like that, the easier our job will be and the less time we'll need to take away from actually handling matters for the legislature.
Question that section. Representative Ringo.
Mr. Chamoff, I'm just curious about the section of representing a party in court at the discretion, at the direction of the Legislative Council Committee. When did that happen?
Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, during my tenure that has happened three times. First, The Legislative Council Committee directed the Legislative Council to represent a group of senators in a legal challenge to the authority of an appointed official to continue to serve in office after the Senate had rejected his reappointment. That action is still pending. A second instance occurred when an explanatory statement committee had its work challenged in the Supreme Court, and the Legislative Council Committee directed the Legislative Council to provide representation to the members of that committee. The Attorney General doesn't provide a defense in that case because the Attorney General considers the members of the explanatory committee not to be public officials, even though they may be sitting members of the legislature and serving a function imposed by statute. The third instance in which the committee has directed us to take legal action, but which did not involve in any way someone that could be considered a private party, was to attempt to appear as for the committee as an amicus curiae in the in a federal court case dealing with water rights.
Another question? Okay.
I'm sorry.
Oh, Representative Shetterly.
Just one thing. Obviously, the world is turning even without having addressed this, but in looking at sub 2 of section 2, in the second sentence, you do list the statewide, the judicial department, and any other statewide officials, but not the governor. And I see that the governor is covered under the first sentence, but only as approving agency requests. If we are trying to create an exhaustive litany of judicial department and the other statewide elected officials, would we also want to put the governor in the second sentence so the governor can initiate his own requests? As I know, again, is happening, and so obviously nothing is not happening here that could be, but it seems to me that if we're looking at the language, the first sentence really only brings the governor into play as approving the request of a state agency. The second sentence talks about requests prepared at the specific bills prepared at the specific request of these elected officials, and that litany doesn't include the governor.
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, that's an excellent suggestion.
Any other question? Mr. Chamoff, please continue.
The third section of the bill deletes the language that prescribes how the committee is to elect its own chair. As was pointed out in the discussion that Representative Shetterly and I had a few moments ago, the rules of your body's control over the procedures prescribed in statute, and the rules provide for the Speaker and the President to appoint the co-chairs of the committee, and so we're simply proposing deleting language that the body doesn't follow anymore.
Any questions? Continue, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 4. Currently, the law says that the Office of Legislative Counsel may not share confidential drafts. In practice, we do. We have for many years provided copies of drafts to the Legislative Fiscal Officer and to the Legislative Revenue Officer so that those legislative officials can get a head start in preparing the analyses that they need to so that your bills can move through the process. The committee thinks that sharing of information is beneficial to the process, but given that it is in fact a deviation from a statutory command, we have in sections 4, 5, and 6 put that specific language before you so that if you want us to continue with that practice, we will do so, and if you don't want us to, we won't.
Any questions? Representative Shetterly?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question, I guess, Greg, members of course, attorneys who serve in legislative council have the obligation in the rules of professional code of professional conduct that also imposes the confidentiality requirement on them. It also carries sanctions with it, I guess, potentially for violation of the rules if they violate the obligation of confidentiality. We don't have any corresponding sanctions or enforcement, do we, for disclosure by revenue or fiscal officers? Not that we do, not that we need them necessarily, but I'm just raising that point.
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, not that I'm aware of, but I can't imagine one of the folks in those offices talking out of school.
One more. The other question is just more drafting question in 5 and 6, where once the disclosure has been made to LFO or to legislative revenue, they may not reveal to any person, not an employee of those offices. It's just a question. Is that clear enough that, in fact, the requester can get that information?
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, yes.
Another question? Continue, Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In Section 7, that's on page 4, line 40, we've added another subsection to the statute that references back to the requirement that the ORS be provided on the Internet. We have a copyright in the Oregon Revised Statutes. We sell it. That's how we make much of the money that goes into operating our office. We hope you'll include that subsection in the list of actions that, if taken, wouldn't impair our copyright. You know, there are people who have made the argument that because we put the Oregon Revised Statutes available to the public on the Internet, that means we can't continue to maintain a copyright in it, and this change would make it sure or clear that, yes, we can.
Any questions? Copyright issues? Please continue, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Section 8. ORS 171.572, which we recommend that you repeal, is a direction to the Legislative Council to review administrative rules. There's already a direction in Chapter 183 as part of a more comprehensive statutory scheme for reviewing administrative rules, and the provision in 171 appears to be left over from an earlier time and should have been taken out when the new provisions in ORS Chapter 183 were added. ORS 173.140 requires the Legislative Council to help a petitioner write a statewide initiative measure if the petitioner brings in the signature of 50 supporters. I think that's supposed to show a measure of support for the measure that would entitle that person to obtain drafting services. In practice, in the nearly 50 years that that law has been on the books, no one has ever used it. It's much easier to simply contact your local legislator and ask them for a note from mother to use our drafting services. And because this law, not having been used, appears to be obsolete, we recommend its repeal.
Any questions?
question?
Representative Shetterly, you have no questions.
Hey.
Okay.
Well, I do have one question.
Okay, Representative Shetterly.
Council. Greg, getting back to sections 5 and 6. I'm thinking under the, I guess it's in the evidence code, that a disclosure of a privileged communication or basically waives the privilege for all purposes. And so I guess the question is, if we build into this process disclosure by legislative counsel to LRO and LFO, under, not under this statute, but under the other rules relating to privileges and confidential communications, does that waive the privilege for other purposes?
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, I don't see this as a waiver in any case.
Well, I'm thinking of the attorney-client privilege. It's a disclosure to a party outside of that attorney-client relationship.
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, I believe that a good argument could be made that the legislative fiscal officer and the legislative revenue officer, being other legislative service agency directors, are sufficiently close to the legislative council as to make disclosure to them not to a third party.
You have a question?
Madam Chair.
Representative Ringel.
Well, just as a comment, I mean, that makes sense to me. They almost seem like they're in an agency capacity. And I can just think in my personal practice, there's lots of times I've used consultants of various kinds. And I think an analogy could be made to the fiscal and revenue offices.
Any other question on that issue?
Hey,
Mr. Ringel.
Comment. I think we need to make it clear in the legislative history of this. That's in what we intend. I agree with you. I think the argument could be made that to ensure that it's not a waiver. Why don't we simply say so? Evidence code notwithstanding, it is considered, you know, something like that. Couldn't you?
Statute. Any comment or question on that?
Well, for one thing, then you're implying that everything that's occurred up to date has not been privileged. I don't think you'd want to create that impression.
I have a question on this last one. The measure, paragraph here in regards to initiative measures, it has not been used?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Is that because people don't know about it?
Madam Chair, I can't tell you why people haven't used it. I know that on occasion a citizen will call us up and say, hi, we'd like help. In what form do you want your 50 signatures, and we'll say, don't bother, just, you know, where do you live, call your representative, and then the representative gives us permission to work with them. So when there's been some contact like that, then the petitioner, prospective petitioner, has obtained the services without needing to obtain the 50 signatures.
So basically they have been advised that you don't need to go to all the work of getting 50 signatures to come to our doorstep, just go to your representative.
Madam Chair, when they talk to us about it, yes.
Representative Lowe.
On the other hand, if this, thank you, Madam Chair, if this provision in the law were to remain in the law and people were to be made aware of it, wouldn't we get a lot less confusing, poorly drafted initiatives floating out there. If they had the valuable scrutiny of careful drafting at the get-go, if people knew about this, I think they would use it. Wouldn't it be lovely if the drafters of Ballot Measure 7 had availed themselves of your services so that we could have something that was clearer as to what the intent was when the voters voted on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, we agree that the laws of the state would benefit from our
careful scrutiny.
Participation in the process of drafting initiative measures. Our experience is that the petitioners who want our help come to us for help, and those who don't want our help don't, and they have specific reasons for not choosing to use our services.
Subtly put.
I guess my view on this is that perhaps this was put in for the very purpose of facilitating the initiative process when citizens did not want to go through their legislator. And I guess that's my question as to why we would consider deleting something that is part of our state government process of governing by the people. Maybe they don't want to go through their legislator, but they don't know they have another way to do it. I guess my question is, if they don't know this, how can they avail themselves of it? Maybe we haven't done a very good job of educating them in how to facilitate their own initiative process. And in there, I don't mean to say them and us, but I mean in the public's view of how to facilitate the initiative process.
Madam Chair, that could quite easily be the case. We don't have a strong feeling on this particular issue one way or the other. The committee simply looks for opportunities to shorten rather than lengthen the ORS, and this was an instance in which a law no longer seemed to have any use, but if it retains some use simply by existing, then it may be responsible to retain it.
Any questions? Representative Lowe.
Madam Chairman, I guess it's more of a comment than a question. It seems to me that in this housekeeping bill, most of the things that we have discussed before we arrived at this session were housekeeping issues, but the removal of this particular session seems to be more of an issue of policy than simple cleaning up the statute. And I'm wondering if perhaps it might be wiser if we had an alternative form of this bill and this section and separated out so that the discussion on them could proceed in the policy mode rather than in just the clean up the statute effort that it seems to be included in this one. Just a thought. I would rather see it separated because I do think that this notion of public access to the drafting services if the public knew about it, it would help. And to remove this tool from the hands of the public is something that should be carefully considered.
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, we can easily prepare an amendment to take ORS 173-140 out of Section 8.
Any further questions or comments? Okay, in regards to the suggested changes in here, anyone suggest that we recommend Mr. Chamoff make those changes and resubmit?
And we'll do the governor in Section 2 as well.
Okay. The governor in Section 2, which we discussed earlier, and then this last one. Okay.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
As long as he's redrafting and no, I don't know, Greg, if you want to make it a separate amendment so we don't get to take down. I would be interested in an amendment that makes explicit, I think, what our assumption is with regard to disclosure of a confidential draft measure to LFO and legislative revenue that it doesn't for any other purposes waive
yes. Great.
The attorney-client privilege between the member and LC.
So we have three changes. New draft.
Yes. And again, that could be a separate amendment if we want to talk about that separately. I'll leave it up to Mr. Chamoff.
Any other question or comment on that? Representative Lowe.
I probably should have asked this question when we were discussing the other bill, but I apologize for coming in late and I didn't have the benefit of the full discussion on it. Maybe it could be considered here. But I've been playing around with the idea that when initiatives and so forth are drafted by whomever, whether it's done by you or by somebody independently of your assistance, the public should know who is making a living from drafting the bill, what their salary is, what their direct benefit is to them as a product of processing the bill. For example, if somebody has a cottage industry of proposing initiatives and so forth, then couldn't the voter's pamphlet statement be required to say what their profit is from doing that directly? I don't know how to go about doing that or even how to make the request succinct enough that your eyebrows aren't raising.
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, what I suggest you do is have a visit with Mr. Reutlinger and see if he can help you flesh out that idea.
One of those confidential bills.
Yeah, one of those other bills. Okay.
Let me use his name.
Representative Shetter, you have a question?
I'm sorry, have you closed the hearing?
No, I haven't yet. I was getting ready to, but do you have another question?
No, I'll wait until after you close the hearing.
Okay. A hearing on House Bill 2043 is hereby closed, and we will continue when we have a new draft from Mr. Chamoff. Excuse me, Representative Shetterly.
I would move that we reopen the work session on, was it 2042 that we passed out, that Representative Lowe? Did you miss the
yes.
Bill?
Yes.
Yeah, I would
no,
move
I was there.
Oh, you were here? Did you get here for that?
2042?
No.
No, I don't think you did.
No, I'm sorry. I think the first one.
Yeah, I would move that we reopen the work session then on, I think that is 2042, to allow Representative Lowe to cast a vote.
Okay. We reopen the hearing on House Bill 2042.
Is that a work session?
Excuse me. A work session on 2042 for Representative Lowe.
Aye.
Thank you. 2042 is hereby closed. Okay.
If I could make an announcement.
Yes, we have an announcement.
First of all, I think I've gone around and introduced myself to everyone. I'm Andrea Chartel, and I'm going to be working as your counsel on the House Judiciary Civil Subcommittee. I finally got a phone Friday afternoon, and if you see phone lists around, any number probably it's probably wrong. So my current phone number, I believe, is 986-1664. So please feel free to call me if you have questions or want to talk about what's going on, anything like that. I'll be happy to work with you or come to your office, whatever works for you. Okay?
Andrea, could you spell your last name?
Yes, it's S-H-A-R-T-E-L.
One L.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I have a question about procedures, just so I know what to expect on a regular basis. Is there a way to get the agenda before we show up in the morning with the copies of the materials, or how?
You should have received that.
Okay.
Is there anyone who did not?
Well, Madam Chair, I think what we got was the agendas, but not the staff measure summaries. I got the agenda Friday, but not the SMSs.
And the answer to that is I prepare those. And quite frankly, probably no. In the beginning, when things are set out and going pretty slow, I should be able to do that. But I can't. There's no way I can guarantee that when we get to.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. But the agendas were delivered to each.
Yes, you should have gotten your agenda.
I probably did.
And if you have a specific question about a bill, or you, you know, want more information, okay, be sure and call me. But I'm gonna, from what I understand, I'm going to be calling and talking to people maybe up until the night before, so I may not,
right,
be able to get the staff measure summaries before.
Maybe wrong.
Although I will have some advantage in that we're meeting every Monday and Wednesday. That
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have a question?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to reiterate something for Ms. Chartel's point. Having held her position before, given the amount of time that committee counsel is given to prepare the staff measure summaries and to gather the information, it is virtually impossible to get them prepared before the committee hearings.
We are regularly scheduled to meet Monday and Wednesday morning, 8 a.m. So unless you have other notice, so just put it on the schedule. And so our next session will be Wednesday, 8 a.m.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, I'm just wondering, are the summaries ready Monday morning then any earlier than 8 a.m.?
Well, last night I emailed them to Ann at 10:30, she printed them out probably sometime at 7:15. If you'd like, I could also email them to you.
That would be marvelous.
Yeah,
if we
when
could
I get
them the night
that
before.
Might be something. When I get them done, I can put you on a list. I can put everybody on a list.
Don't bother me.
No. Okay.
Don't bother me.
Then I can put everybody but Representative Shetterly on a list and email you with them as soon as I get them done.
If it's just if it's only a matter of point and click and no additional work
no,
for
that's
you,
no problem. Yeah.
I would love to receive them. Of course, that perhaps a few nights I'll be here at 10 o'clock in front of my computer.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.